This podcast is presented by the Prince George's County Memorial Library System.
Hi, I'm Maria.
I'm Heather.
I'm Vilma.
And I'm Darlene.
And this is our podcast, These Books Made Me, Manga Edition. Today we're going to be talking about Sailor Moon. Friendly warning as always, this podcast contains spoilers. If you don't yet know Chibi Chibi's true identity, continue at your own risk.
Naoko Takuchi, the creator of Sailor Moon, once said, "Heroes of justice tend to come from a specific type, but I wanted to make her unconventional. She's a crybaby and lazy, and sometimes even cheats a little. I wanted to draw a normal girl like that." So Usagi is pretty self-centered, although she matures over the course of the story's run, and her selfishness and self-centeredness come to the surface too. I keep drawing her thinking, what a little witch. When I read that, I immediately thought of Jane Austen's quote about Emma, where she said, "I'm going to take a heroine whom no one but myself will much like," which I thought was very interesting because Sailor Moon is very well liked amongst people. But I don't know, when I was younger, she wasn't my favorite character. And I think that it was because, you know, she was very a crybaby. She wasn't very adept. And everyone else seemed like they had better leadership qualities than she did. And so it's just natural to kind of gravitate towards one of them because they kind of present more confident and in charge. But one thing that's great about Usagi is that she kind of leads by example and by her own warmth. And I think that that's what fans have kind of come around to really loving about her over the years. I don't know. How do you guys feel?
I love the Emma quote. I think that's so great because it's really true. Like, especially at the beginning, I don't think Usagi is the character that anyone identifies with, right? I mean, she really struggles. Like, it's a struggle for her. She's constantly crying. She constantly is like, I don't want to do this. We talked about sort of the reluctant heroine aspect, but it is sort of a coming of age story for her because we watch her mature. We watch her sort of grow into her powers. We watch her eventually, you know, learn to, I guess, embrace her role. But then that also does bring up with the other characters, why do they follow her? And this idea of like how much of it is choice, how much of it is that they're just kind of accepting their fate or their destiny to be in that role to her as the leader. There's a lot to explore with Usagi's leadership qualities. What do you all think?
Yeah, Usagi definitely, like, she was not the heroine I was looking for when I was younger. As I've gotten older, I've learned to understand her and be more accepting of the fact that, you know, she wasn't off looking for adventure. She saw this cat being, you know, bullied in the street by these kids, and she jumped in to protect it, which right there, she was exhibiting warmth and leadership in a certain way. And I guess it could almost seem like the other scouts didn't have a choice but to follow her, but you do see her grow. And sometimes she takes like two steps forward, one back. Like, she's kind of a crybaby throughout and she does some immature things, but there is consistent growth, like, and it's with that warmth. She's able to put Amy at ease when Amy comes from a very sheltered kind of, like, she's very alone and she's immediately able to connect with Usagi. And Usagi is the one that's usually trying to be a peacekeeper in things. Like, she wants to talk about things, as opposed to when we're first introduced to Uranus and Neptune, you know, the other Sailor Scouts are immediately like suspicious of them and they don't trust them and they kind of want to fight. And then later on, when that new group is introduced, when Saturn is introduced, again, it's like very violent. Let's fight them. They're our enemies. And Usagi is usually the one going like, can we like talk about this for 2 seconds? When before she had been the most immature. I definitely agree that the other scouts in the beginning showed more leadership potential. And the thing is that she leads with her warmth, with her love, with being protective. And at one point she even says, you know, I'm not trying to save the world. I'm just trying to save the people I love. I'm trying to protect the people I love, which I thought was beautiful. It's very clear that all of her leadership comes from her loving the people around her. And the scouts, although it is predestined, definitely, they genuinely love her back, which I think kind of takes away some of the negative connotations for me, because they all choose to follow her. Maybe it was predestined, but it comes from a place of such love and respect that I feel like it works out fairly well. I don't feel like they ever feel like they're missing out. They're pretty fulfilled in what they're doing because they love Usagi the way they do.
Yeah, she's very naive, but she's maybe the most empathetic
of the group, which is why she's such a crybaby. I mean, she feels everything so closely when her friends are injured, or even when she comes across some of the villains like Queen Beryl or even like Sailor Galaxia. It's like she feels for them. And it's just like it's very emotional for her. And I think that's also why everyone else protects her. I mean, Ami was very, very quiet, but she's got a strength to that quietness. Everyone does. But I guess because Usagi's just like a very sweet, empathetic character, I guess everyone seems to want to use that or want to protect her for it, which I guess when we like talked about keeping her clean or like away from all that evil. But she definitely uses her strengths with that to kind of like bring out the good in others. So I think that's also why it's a good leadership quality, because she knows how to kind of pull that out.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's also great that at least you see it in the manga a lot, but she is aware of that kind of effect that she has on other people. Mm-hmm. And it's more so in a way that she feels guilty that people fight for her and that people seem to die for her. Spoilers, I guess. but that kind of self-awareness, I think, also detracts from it being such a like negative image in your mind, I think. I also thought that it was really interesting that the creator kind of used a lot of her negative qualities as parts of her power. Like, I think in the beginning, when she really was struggling with everything, her cry in itself was like a power move, which I thought was really interesting. It's sort of like empowering these really like negative traits that people have with like teenage girls, or like usefulness in general, like crying. Because we did have that whole discussion about how people want to protect her from these things. There was that point where Tuxedo Mask or Mamoru didn't want to like burden her with what he was going through because he didn't want to put more on her. And I remember that was like the tension that I created as well. So I don't know that I always liked it, because I sometimes felt like that tension was kind of unwarranted, because they could just be like open and honest with each other. Like, what would her knowing about what was like, it's going on regardless, like she's going to have to deal with it anyway. And yet they like would keep things from her in protecting her. I think they're also protecting that vision of the future and that peace. And I think that that's also what keeps them going. But we did have that discussion before about how we felt about how like undying their loyalty was to her, and how that was kind of very strange, because she gets to live her life. She gets to, you know, marry someone and have a child. And they seem very much like that they've accepted their fate, that they're just going to protect her and protect the kingdom. And that's primarily their goal. And it's brought up many times, especially with someone like Sailor Venus, who has a lot of dreams about being like an idol and she wants to date around. And then it's like twice in the manga you get her having this realization that, no, she's already sworn loyalty to one person only. And then that's Usagi. And I'm just like, I feel like you can still have your life and still protect her and this kingdom. And I didn't like how it was one or the other.
Sailor Moon is essentially a romantic story, and not just romantic in the form of like, oh, love between people, but like romanticism, you know, this idea of devotion to beauty and truth and peace. And you have this initially damsel in distress, even though she's very powerful, like she doesn't know her powers at the beginning. So she's always just, oh, I hope Tuxedo Mask comes and saves me, even though she really doesn't need saving per se. But that is the relationship that's set up at the beginning. And I wonder, with the other girls, like Sailor Venus seems to have the most maybe natural like leadership qualities early on. But the way that she exerts that is almost in the form of like a knight, like in a, you know, a traditional knights and princess and fairy tale and dragon kind of role, where she's not looking to marry the princess. She's giving her life to sort of be in the service of what Sailor Moon embodies, like of her queen. You know, it's this real commitment to she's fundamentally good and pure, and this protectiveness, and that there's some, you know, noble aspect of devoting your life to that that is maybe satisfying to her. But it's interesting just thinking of it in that way, because you would think that this would turn into an inversion of sort of romantic tropes. It never really does, does it? The only like real inversion is that you have more females in roles that are typically reserved for males, like knights, going mm-hmm. to slay the dragon kind of thing. Well, this there usually are girls who are doing that. But at core, I don't know that Usagi really turns any of those tropes on their head, because she retains still throughout that sort of warm helplessness about her, when she is incredibly powerful. It's a very interesting dichotomy contained within that one character. But I think like the through line through the story is pretty classically a romantic story.
Yeah. And she pretty much is the personification of kill him with kindness. Like, I never thought about it until maybe more recently when I was watching the anime again and reading the manga. The Silver Millennium Crystal is pretty much like her pure of heart, right? Yeah. And that light is supposed to shine upon like anything dark in the whole series. I don't know that it's necessarily like an inversion of the trope, but it is nice to kind of have that traditionally like feminine quality, like that empathy and that love and that light, be considered something very strong, almost unbeatably strong. Mm-hmm. Like that's kind of that energy source that all the villains kind of chase after throughout the whole series, not knowing that even if they had it, they wouldn't really know how to do anything with it because they don't possess that pure of heart.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, I guess, going back to the knight trope, or even in Sailor Moon Crystal, we saw Prince Endymion or Mamoru's past life. I mean, he had his knights.
Yeah.
And in the, like Sailor Moon Crystal, you see those knights were paired off with a Sailor Scout.
Yeah.
And each one was killed off. And in order for that to kind of like accomplish, it kind of pushed them to go off and defend Sailor Moon and kind of just step away from those love interests as well.
Yeah, I always felt bad that he never got to keep his knights the way that she kept hers, essentially. Yeah. I guess that'd be too many characters to focus on, but...
I mean, he gets the short end of the stick a lot of times throughout the story. Like, I feel like he has a rough go of it at many points along the way, but, you know, it's not about him, really.
Yeah, I don't know if I brought this up in the first part, but I think Takuchi did say that she doesn't feel that same, like, empathy or pull towards her male characters, and that's why they go through so much, and that's why she can kill them off so easily. So I do think that there's something there. Like, it's not really about them, and I don't think that they were at the forefront of her mind.
Yeah, and I think that's why the anime stepped in and kind of gave Mamoru, like, a huge backstory, and we even seek male-male, like, relationship with him, and I can't remember the character's name, but... with the rose. That's why the rose was so big in the anime itself.
Oh, yeah. For Sailor Moon R, the movie.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that was my favorite one of all of them.
But it's just like a big moment. Mamoru got that glimpse of like male love from this character in the anime movie. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and the anime does that as well. I think even for like Usagi's leadership, I do think that it expands on it because it gives a lot of redemption arc to some of the villains. Mm-hmm. Like the way that rather than her, you know, like Silver Millennium Crystal, just kind of like turning them to dust, a lot of the times it redeems them.
Yeah.
Which I think kind of expands on that notion of how it's supposed to bring about peace and love. And I don't think that we see that in the manga because it's really just like once she like uses that, they're just gone.
Yeah.
So 100% like great in terms of killing off her villains, but it's not really that much of a redemptive story the way that it is in the anime.
Yeah, Mamoru's Four Knights. I think we see them like twice more, and one of those is in a flashback. Mm-hmm. And then like he actually keeps their gems and like they can astral project and they're still watching over him as astral projections, but it's not the same as, you know, Usagi's interactions with her own knight. So it was definitely, like, very lopsided.
I guess that makes it a little harder to swallow what Mamoru says to her about how she'll end up outliving them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
that whole conversation. Back to the downer again. Take it away,
Bobo. Okay, so that was super sad because at the end, once we find out who Chibi-Chibi is, we find out that it's Sailor Moon from the future beyond what we'd already seen her in the future. And the fact that she's there with them and has to take inspiration from her younger teenage self, given the fact that all of Usagi's power seems to come from her love and her relationships, the fact that she couldn't find that in her time and had to go to the past kind of implies that she didn't have anybody at that time to take strength from and to want to protect, which is why she was in the past. And that was just, it seems so very sad because in the last line of the manga, Mamoru does give that kind of very negative very kind of heartbreaking foreshadowing where he's like, you know, you'll outlive us all. I don't remember the wording exactly, but it did imply that she would continue long after all the rest of them had died. And with Usagi, whose relationships are so important to her, that just, it just felt like such a tragic ending to me. Like, as soon as I read that, I was like, what? There's another chapter, right? What is this? No, I don't like this. Yeah, maybe I read too much into it. I'm hoping I read too much into it, but that's kind of like where it ended off in my mind. And that was kind of a bit of a downer.
I think that interpretation is accurate. So, and I think also, but that's a very classic fantasy trope as well, right? Yeah. You have this sort of romanticized notion of the person that outlives everyone else. And there is sort of like a loneliness to the hero's journey. Like you get that a lot in Tolkien.
Mm-hmm. And Merlin also in the Arthurian legends. Yeah. Merlin's the last one left.
Where it's just this idea of this person loves across time and across like the boundaries of, you know, whatever the impediments are. But ultimately, at the end, they're alone, like, because the person with that amount of power just kind of keeps going on and everyone else sort of falls by the wayside. I don't know. It's very like Arwen from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Kind of example. And it's not a like nice, happy ever after bow to put on things at all. I wonder about that choice, too.
And I mean, in a way, you could almost find hope in that, because in that final arc, she was alone for a huge portion of it. And in that final fight, she was alone, which we had not seen before. She always had somebody there, if not to, you know, physically fight with her, then to give her the emotional strength that she needed. That final fight was, you know, her alone. And then it's implied that she's going to be alone in the future. But that doesn't mean she will always be alone. Like, that's kind of a different way I started thinking about it. Maybe now that she's kind of taken strength from her younger self, she can go to the future and try to build new relationships. Or, I don't know, Sailor Moon's all about reincarnation. Maybe it'll be reincarnated again. Who knows? But I was trying to think of how it wouldn't end too heartbreakingly. And I was like, okay, because there is loss in real life. Mm-hmm. And if she could just learn to move forward from that, it wouldn't be the tragic, she's all alone and heartbroken in the future. That's kind of how I started thinking about it, just to try to make myself feel a little better about it. We now know that she can fight alone. She can defeat these huge odds by herself. She has that strength. I guess it would be, how can she handle her personal life? Can she move forward? Which we will not know, because I'm pretty sure she's not going to keep writing these, but it's an interesting way to look forward. And of course, there's always like the fan art and fan doujin. I should probably start looking those up, see what other people have said. Like, fan interpretations are really half of the fun with Sailor Moon, I think.
Yeah.
So there's a lot out there.
Yeah, and the anime, I think, does a really visual interpretation of kind of the fact that she, like you said, she had those relationships along the way, and she's kind of taken strength from that. Mm-hmm. And so even if they're gone, they kind of still exist within her.
Yeah.
And it's kind of sort of that same, you know, the same concept as like grief being like love persevering, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that they may be gone, but they've still given her so much that she still kind of retains all of their love and all the love for them and all their love for her within her. And I guess that might give her some strength. And maybe that's something that she had forgotten and needed to be reminded of.
Yeah.
Guys, I'm going to cry, I think. This week, we're going to play a game courtesy of YouQuiz. Let's find out which Sailor Moon character we are. Okay, for question one, imagine a mysterious cat with a glowing crescent moon on her forehead follows you down the road. You turn towards her and she begins to talk of the apocalypse to come and insists it is your duty to save the world. What do you do, ladies?
Okay, we'll just read the answers we pick because there's so many answers for every question on this quiz because they really are, I think, trying to capture a whole lot of the characters. I'm going to go... I straighten my posture. I say, oh, is it my time to shine? Finally, have I finally been chosen? If this is my burden to bear, then I shall bear it as a hero must. I'm ready. I was born for this.
I panic and run home. I yell as I realize the cat is chasing me. Horror music begins to play in my head as I run.
I ask the cat where she's from and who she is, because I feel like if anything, I'll always ask questions.
I think I'd take her home to explain herself. Let's go to my house and have some tea and talk about this, okay? Okay, question two. In the local bookstore, you...
This one's really tough because, well, okay, we all work in a library, so I feel like bookstores are already like just crises of what to choose for us. I think I would pick the volume of poetry that I know will deeply move me and carry it in my purse, rereading it till its spine cracks.
I would choose some pulp fiction in the sci-fi / horror / thriller genres. It's about the excitement of it all.
That's a good one too, though.
Yeah. I was like, I think I'm going to go for that one.
I think I'm going to be the odd one out and just go to stationery. Okay, question 3. Which of these archetypes do you relate to the most?
Okay, we can read these because there's a lot, but they're one-worders. So like our choices are the mystic, the knight, the princess, the mage, the artist poet, the scholar, the jester, the mentor, the ghost, the lover, or the rebel.
Or the traveler.
Oh, and the traveler. Sorry. Bottom of my scrolling.
I think I'd go with the traveler always.
I'm torn on this one.
Yeah, there's so many good ones.
Yeah.
There are.
I'm thinking the mystic. I'll go with the mystic.
I'll go with the mage.
All right. I think I'm going to go with the princess.
Okay, question 4. You're sitting down at a concert and the people in the chairs in front of you keep taking selfies, which you feature in the background of. What do you do? I'm looking down. I feel very awkward and try to look busy looking down at my phone.
I think I'm exchanging a humorous look with my friend and I don't feel bothered about it. Though I am tempted by the one that says to like basically photobomb them. But I was deterred by everyone's a potential friend after all and striking up a conversation with them. Because I think I would just photobomb them and not like talk to them.
Yeah, that option's not up, but that's
but
the
it's
one
not there. So I'll just laugh about it with my friend.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I would feel very awkward and try to look busy looking down at my phone also.
Yeah, I think I would exchange a humorous look with my friend and not feel too bothered by it.
Question 5. Which of these ideas about apocalypses resonate with you?
These are all really good.
Kind of like we deserve a soft epilogue, my
love.
Yeah,
I like that one.
Yeah.
But because I'm a chicken, I'll probably just go, don't wake me for the end of the world unless it has very good special effects.
I love that one.
I'm torn between sure everything is ending, but not yet. And we stared into the face of death and death blinked first. Those are both good.
All of these are actually really good.
Yeah. And they're quotes. I'm wondering where they're from.
Yeah, me too.
I have heard the languages of the apocalypse and now I shall embrace the silence.
Yeah, that one's good too. Okay, I guess I'll do sure everything is ending, but not yet.
I'll go with we deserve a soft epilogue.
Question 6. You try something you've never tried before, and you're not very good at it the first time, or the second or third times. How would you react?
So I think I would tell myself to stick with it till I'm good. I'm harsh on myself and don't allow myself to be bad at it for longer than I can work myself out of.
I think I'm doing that one as well, just because I'm stubborn.
I think I take it easy. I keep on it out of enjoyment and don't think too much of the results. It generally surprises me when months later people tell me I'm good at it. I mean, that last part, not so much, more the first part.
That's very healthy, though. A really healthy approach.
Yeah, I think I tell myself to stick with it as well.
I am, like, intrigued by who would put, I'm terrible at everything, what you've given me.
I mean, that's a very Gen Z response.
That's a downer.
Okay, question 7. Which of these types would you crush on?
I think I'm going with the funny one who looks out for others and doesn't take themselves too seriously.
Yeah, same. I think so too.
Yeah.
Though most of these are really good too.
Yeah.
Like, who doesn't like a super smart person who's adorably awkward with emotion?
I think I'm going to go with that one.
Or your best friend you've known for years and have your own, like, inside jokes with.
Those or the masked hero in a tuxedo and cape who hands you roses.
I have to say, though, okay, so obviously that's the Usagi one. But, like, in real life, if some dude kept showing up in a tux and, like, throwing a rose and then, like, walking off the scene, that would be so weird. I don't think you would crush on that person at all. You would just worry. You'd probably call the cops because
stalker report.
Why do they keep showing up wherever you go?
Question 8. What kind of story would you star in if you could choose?
This is tough too. These are all good as well. I'm going to go with the ancient epic legend featuring you with a sword that cements you in history as a symbol of valor.
I think I'm going to go with the folktale where you learn a lesson, outwit your beasts, and perhaps even return from the underworld. That one's a little scary at the end, but it seems to end well.
No, I like that one.
I think I'm going to go with the heart-wrenching, almost tragedy with a comfortingly happy ending.
Yeah, I think I'm doing that one too, darling. Question 9. You commission an artist. What do you ask them to paint?
These are just weird.
Yeah. But I like a landscape you keep dreaming
of. That's what I'm going to go with too, because the others, like, I don't, it seems really strange.
Yeah, very, a landscape. Yeah.
Same. Okay, number 10. Choose a concept to be the face of.
Oh, these are all really good too.
Oh yeah, these are all one-worders too. So we have time, honor, love, valor, fate, beauty, comfort, strength, wisdom, creativity, and mirth.
I think as the Ravenclaw that I am, I'm going to choose wisdom.
Nice. I think I'm going to go with comfort.
I'll go full Gryffindor and pick valor.
I think I'll go with creativity. Okay, number 11. A friend hurts your feelings deeply. What do you do?
I forgive them once.
It's that once period.
Mm-hmm. It's ominous, right?
Yeah. Like, what happens next?
Well, you know, fool me once.
I'll probably show up at their house and ask if we can discuss this privately.
Yeah, same.
Also, a mature and healthy response.
I mean, I would actually also prefer that one. I don't know if I'd show up at their house. I would, like, text and maybe talk over the phone.
Well, you have the option to send an ambiguous, hard-to-read text and see what they do, Phil.
I mean, I might actually do that one instead of the phone.
That feels like subtweeting, though, right?
I'll say I'll show up at their house just because I want to pretend I'd be mature about it.
Number 12. Do you like the zodiac sign you were born with?
Yes, we're great.
Agree. I like my sign fine. Though I do like the one that says, I think it must be fun to be all of the signs and that there's like something to like about every sign.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I feel like every time I look at different signs, I'm always like, oh, it'd be cool to like have that personality trait associated with my sign.
But I wonder if that's where your birth chart comes in. It's just like your rising sign, your moon sign.
Unfortunately, my rising and my sun are the same, so I can't even escape it.
Okay, number 13. Choose one of these ways of looking at people.
Okay, these are easy to read. So astrology, MBTI, Dungeons and Dragons classes, individuals, threats, potential friends, an audience for my iconicism. Crowds too big to fathom with some unique faces I recognize only as themselves. And aspects of one enormous concept of humanity. I'm going with Dungeons and Dragons classes.
I think astrology is the most fun.
Yeah, I agree.
Individuals, I think, although I do love an audience for my iconicism. That's an interesting way to look at it.
Are you ready to look at our results?
Oh my God.
Let's go for
it. Let's go.
Oh my God.
Oh, interesting.
I'm Chibiusa again.
Okay,
so you are even changing some to try to get
change several of my responses. Apparently, this is who I am. All right, so I'm blunt, sharp-tongued, funny, and iconic in an effortless way. Very cute, a little bit mean, but forgivably so. Easily pleased with presents, simple at heart, a total jock. Just cannot with this quiz. How did you guys do?
So I actually got Sailor Saturn. This is probably like the third different person that I've gotten, but she actually does fit my zodiac sign because all of them kind of fit a zodiac sign. But it says melancholic, tendency towards appearing gothic, not true, the weight of the world on your shoulders, good with secrets, strong on the inside, ultra powerful, but few realize it because of how private you are.
I got the same.
Okay, I got Sailor Pluto.
Okay.
Oh, cool.
Nice. Lonely. Harsh. Very stylish, very graceful, willing to look for the good in others, hard on yourself, very powerful, but also silly at unexpected times, good with secrets, the type others look up to. Though now I'm curious about, you said each character aligns with a zodiac sign, Darlene. Mm-hmm. Which ones do they go with?
So, you know how like each sign has like a planet ruler?
Mm-hmm. Oh, they match.
Yeah. So Leo, I think it would actually be Tuxedo Mask. Tuxedo Mask is the Leo. And someone was like, of course Tuxedo Mask would be the Leo.
I mean, showing up in a tux and like rescuing somebody and throwing a flower at them, that is fair. That's fair. A Leo thing to do.
Let me see Sailor Pluto, though.
Scorpio. I think, yeah.
Okay. And then like Sailor Moon and Sailor Mini Moon, both are Cancer.
Yeah, they're both Cancers. Yeah. Actually, no, this one says that Sailor Mini Moon is a Gemini. That's wrong, then. Maybe this is not the most reputable source, because I have seen the one where they're both Cancers.
We did want to do a blog post about blood types, because mm-hmm. she was very intentional about what she chose for each of them. But yeah, I think it's nice. Like on one hand, yeah, I've said that I don't really like this whole idea of fate and that everyone's like predetermined to be a certain way. And like, I do like the intentionality, I think, of like all of her characters and that she chose very specific like birth dates for them. Mm-hmm. And I think even the color scheme of their outfits very much mirror their planets and how like we visualize each planet. So I thought it was nice. Very cohesive.
Yeah, there's a lot of depth there. I like that too.
Each episode, we ask whether our book passes the Bechdel test. The Bechdel test asks whether a work features two female characters who talk to each other about something that doesn't involve men or boys. So does it pass?
Yes.
Yeah.
With an asterisk.
Yes, I say yes also, but not by as much as one would hope, especially with Usagi's character, because so much of her is centered around her relationship with Mamoru, and, you know, a lot of her motivations are centered around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say it also passes, but there is a stark difference, I think, between the manga and the anime, because the anime was mostly through the eyes of male animators, and I think even the creator of Sailor Moon has kind of touched on it before, where there are certain things that they kind of got away with and certain things that they just added that she probably would not have. And you can see that very clearly in some of the episodes and how they kind of portray teenage girls and how they think teenage girls should be. So very much a yes with an asterisk.
Yeah, I agree as well. A lot of the relationships, like, I mean, as you mentioned, Darlene, like the anime was different. I mean, even Mamoru becomes very central character with some of the other girls. So
it didn't like that, how big a role he was. And then that weird, like, fighting for his attention. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the manga, it was very clear very early on, like they were endgame and nobody else even thought of like, no, that was not something they... It definitely felt like they did it just to create that tension and rivalries to play up these, like, traditional female tropes. And I was just kind of like, this is unnecessary. I don't like this.
Yeah, well, and I think we talked about how the anime had to fill a lot more time.
Yeah.
There's a lot of filler episodes where they're just kind of cranking out content. But I think it's really telling that for the filler, like, where they've diverged from, like, the main plot, oftentimes those are the most obvious, like, oh, a guy totally wrote this, because it does hinge on a male character, or it hinges on, even if the male character is not a big part of it, they're talking about a male character the whole time, right? Or they're talking about getting with a male character. It's very, very centered on sort of that is the focus for every girl in the series in those episodes. It's just extreme.
Yeah, I found that really annoying, because it played up on all of these traditionally teenage girls. Like, this is what teenage girls talk about. It's like, how many teenage girls have you talked to, though? Because this is not what teenage girls talked about. Near the end, I forget which volume it was, but they actually did like four chapters of all of the scouts preparing for their exams to get into high school. And I love those four chapters. They were hysterical, because Mamoru was barely in them. So it was literally just all of them talking with each other and acting the way I know for a fact teenage girls act, because I was a teenage girl. I was like, we need more of this content. You know, those are fun.
Yeah. Even within the anime, the original anime with Pluto, we see her and Neo King Endymion. Mm-hmm. She's obviously very attracted to him, and her being lonely, as Heather pointed out in the exam. In the test, he becomes the center even in the future.
Yeah, I mean, he was the only male, so it kind of felt forced, like they had to focus all of their romantic intentions towards him because he was the only male in the group. I mean, the outer planets, honestly, they all had really sad stories. Like, there was a lot of loneliness, being alone. I mean, Saturn's whole thing was that all of the other scouts feared her until the very end because she was supposed to be a world ender or whatever. Spoiler alert. So all of them were so alone. And then they had this one, like, epitome of male beauty and male wisdom and male whatever. And they all, like, fell in love with him. I was like, no. Like, no. It was weird. I didn't like that.
Yeah, and I think even things that traditionally we look at as possibly being problematic about it, like the sailor suit and just even like how small it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it's really interesting, the just juxtaposition between the male and female gaze, because even though Takuchi was the one that drew the sailor's guardians, the sailor suit, the idea for it actually came from her male editor. Mm-hmm. So he was just like, yeah, you can do whatever story you want, but I, you know, they should be in a sailor suit. And she was like, okay, that's fine. I'm just going to do my own story based on that. And then I think her input was that she really wanted Tuxedo Mask to appear in a tuxedo, which I thought was really interesting because I think on one hand, you have a kind of sexualized like uniform in Japan. Mm-hmm. And like there are many things written about the sailor suits and usefulness. But I thought it was really interesting that her input was that she really wanted the male protagonist to be in a tuxedo. But yeah, I mean, there are certain things that I do feel like the anime added that just kind of weren't even really necessary. One thing was the skeevy grandpa, Ray's grandpa. And I know that she alludes to it in the manga, but it was just like very, you know, it was kind of glossed over. But I do feel like the anime kind of took it a step further and they had a whole episode on it. And I feel like it was more so played for laughs, like, oh, this is just a facet of his personality, like, whatever. And I know that Ray scolds him, but I still think that the whole episode plays for laughs. And I don't even know how I feel about that. This is terrible behavior. Like, he should stop. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, he should not be talking to these girls this way. And then also, like, the transformation scene. I know a lot of people talk about it in the anime because they almost kind of present nude and, I mean, with like a lot of different like colors and background changes. But I know that there was like a lot of talk around it at that time. And it's really interesting because I could see it in the manga and not think anything of it. And I feel like it's because I know a woman drew it.
Well, in the manga, it's also like a page.
Part
of it with the anime is it's so prolonged.
Yeah.
I know some of that's probably just the practical nature of like, hey, I can recycle this stock footage and it kills off this much, you know, time in an episode. And when you're trying to churn out an animated show, you probably love that stuff because it's less work that you have to do in each episode if you can kind of keep going back to that well over and over. But it is long. Like, the transformations in the anime take forever. And it's just like, she's spinning clearly like in nude silhouette. And I don't know.
And the close-up shots of certain things. I'm just
There's a lot going on there. And I think you're right. Like in the manga, it's not as concerning because it is, it's just you hit it and you move on. Mm-hmm. Like even when Usagi like changes into different costumes, essentially, like when she transforms in the manga, it's like nothing. Mm-hmm. In the show, it feels so skeevy at times because she's like 14 and then they have this transformation into a like hypersexualized male version of a character. So the flight attendant kind of costume or like even the princess costume. Mm-hmm. Okay, she turned into a princess, but she also turned into like an extremely voluptuous princess and it's just cleavage everywhere.
Yeah.
And then the anime does things like showing her in the bath and it feels a lot more centered on that than the manga ever does. Yeah, I don't know. It's some of that is just because I think it got away from the female creator and I imagine it would have been very different. But some of it is you're like in it for so long too. Whereas with the manga, you're really more just in the story and you're moving along through it. In the anime, you're just kind of like sitting there like, wow, this is a lot, you know? Like, and it, as an adult, it's disturbing at times. Like, I think the scene with the grandfather, like, it does not play well at all. I think Naru's whole relationship, that is yikes. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things where they are really like focusing on the way that they're presenting the girl. Like, she's leaning over. She's taking clothing off. There's just a lot there. And you think about, like, again, those are supposed to be 14-year-old girls.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Even for male gaze, I feel like it goes a little skeevy.
Yeah. I wonder, I mean, I guess that's the thing with the anime is that you kind of live with them in their day-to-day lives a little bit more. And so it just makes that stark difference from them in their school uniform, which is longer and more age-appropriate, to the sailor suit, which then you're just like, wow, this is like incredibly short. I think that that difference just hits you more once you like see it, because you like literally saw the whole long transformation, and then now you know that like she's bearing a lot more leg, and there's a lot more emphasis on her chest because you know, like the way that her suit is silhouetted. So
and in the anime, I feel like the transformation, it makes it like more clear that when they transform, this idealized body happens to them as well. It's not just that the outfit changes, their whole figure transforms each time they do that. And then that also, you know, just from the perspective of, we've kind of talked about with the manga, especially like feeling like this is a real empowerment of femininity, that like you can be strong and be traditionally feminine and into pretty things and girly. But in the anime, it's like, okay, well, what sort of that idealized femininity looks like to them seems so much more sexualized than it ever presents in the manga. Yeah. So like, okay, I guess in the anime, sometimes you have the girls talking about something that's not boys. Like, I don't know, Ami talks about her test scores sometimes, or like things like that, but it's pretty minimal. Like it really, for as much time as we spend with all of the female characters in the anime, it's really uncommon that they talk about something that doesn't go back to one of the male characters or wanting a boyfriend or things like that.
Unless they're specifically in a battle setting or preparing for a battle.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Those are the only times they're not really focusing on boys and romance. And it's kind of like there's more to them than just like the warrior and then this typical teenage girl. Like, you know, you've got all these episodes. Give us more well-rounded characters. Come on now. Like,
yeah.
And we never really got that, unfortunately.
I mean, for anyone who's new to reading the manga as well, I mean, if you don't know Chibiusa's background as well, her transformation, and even when she becomes Black Lady, it's really, really crazy how that quickly changes. I mean, the slit in her dress in the manga is much shorter than it is in the anime. And then just like that sexualization of her, like Vilma and I, when we were at the branch, we had been looking at when she went to school, like her classmates, just how like much taller and like how much voluptuous, again, they were compared to her. And it's like, and what do you see? You see Mamoru with a nosebleed?
Yeah, that was weird. That was in some extra chapters after it had already ended. And that entire, I never even finished that chapter because I just found it like so weird and repulsive. It was like Chibiusa, I think they had like a field trip or something. Yeah. And then these other two girls that were supposed to be her age. Yeah. And yet they did not have the body type of, what is she supposed to be, like eight or something like that? Like they were developed and they were in skimpy clothes and Mamoru got a nosebleed. And I was like, what is happening right now? This is a level of disturbing that thankfully was not in the main, so I'm just treating it as not canon, but I'm sure it's because I was like, this is putting my opinion of Mamoru like down several levels, because I'm like, ew, no, what is happening right now?
Yeah, I'm glad someone helped her edit that out or was like, yeah, I don't think that that's because I mean, then again, that goes back to just this idea of, yeah, you can have a female creator, but they can kind of perpetuate a lot of these stereotypes and a lot of these tropes. And it's not always like there'll be this idealized like feminist literature just because it's written by a woman.
And they're from the same society that's creating the, they are in the society that's creating the male gaze version of things. Like how much of that gets internalized? Like you can never completely divorce yourself from your culture and your society that you've grown up with. So it has to infuse it on some level.
And it speaks to that larger conversation about like, even if you have like, you know, for the anime, even if you have male creators trying to create a really strong heroine, at the end of the day, like who's the one behind the scenes, like, doing that, and who gets to decide, like, what that strength looks like? And so even in a, when it's supposed to be empowering for girls, it's still with, you know, like, male creators in mind and what they had, what they champion as, like, their form of empowerment. So, yeah, I think there's, like, a lot to discuss there in terms of how the creators definitely shape how you view a character. But yeah, I mean, going to back to Black Lady, I don't think I've ever read those extra chapters because that does not sound familiar to me. But I remember I have gone back to like reading the whole Black Lady arc and liking it more so the second time around or when I revisited, because I felt like I kind of got a sense of what she was trying to say, that like Chibiusa is a character that was very much sheltered and she lives in a really in a society of peace. And so there's no real growth, I guess, that's happening with her. And so we find out that she's actually like 900 years old, mm-hmm. but she's presenting as like a 6-year-old. And so she looks very, very young and she acts very young as well. She's lived a very sheltered life. There's no conflict or anything. And it doesn't even seem like she has any friends. I guess what the villain in that arc kind of exploits is that idea that she feels like she's not being seen by those around her and that she's not being allowed to grow. And so it seems like this sort of twisted, demented like view on this idea that like growth and maturation means growing into your sensuality. And I think that that's why that specific dress was chosen mm-hmm. and the way that she looks, that there's something kind of like deep and dark about that, because it was kind of one of her like deep and dark desires.
That whole Black Lady arc with Chibiusa's background, actually, it made me feel sorry for her. Like, there's a lot of things about Chibiusa that I have issues with, but that actually made me feel very sorry for her, because you get that she's incredibly lonely. Mm-hmm. The only people around her are her parents and her parents' friends. As much as she loves them, and we see that she has that bond with Pluto, she's still very lonely. And there is actually a scene where it looks like she's being bullied by other children. So she's experiencing these negative emotions. She doesn't really have people that she can talk to other than Diana the kitten. She doesn't really have her own anything. So there's this repression of all these negative emotions, because it must be hard to sit there and be experiencing these negative things and having these negative emotions when, you know, your mom is the epitome of what it means to be good and peace and right and justice mm-hmm. and a woman. And your father is the male version of this. So everything should be perfect, but it's really not. Yeah. And so you're internalizing and repressing. So it made me understand her character a little more. I mean, I still have a lot of issues with her, but it definitely, that arc made me, you know, feel bad for her. And when you think about it, I forget which villain it was, but they talked about the fact that Sailor Moon and the crystal extending people's lives and everything, it wasn't necessarily good. It wasn't right. It changed what humanity is. Like, I wonder if Chibiusa in a way also represented that, because she didn't get mm-hmm. to grow. She got stunted too. Yeah. And that wasn't necessarily a good thing for her own mental state. That whole thing, just a lot of food for thought there. But going back to the way the girls' bodies were represented, I felt like a lot of it was also the creators, the animators, being very aware of what was expected of them. Like, mm-hmm. it felt a lot like fan service in a lot of mm-hmm. cases. They were just following tropes that kind of worked on anime across the board. Like the pervy old man, that is seen in so many different yeah. anime and manga. Mm-hmm. You have at least one of them in Ranma, in Dragon Ball Z. Just, you know, pull one up and odds are there will be a perverted, like the pervy sage in Naruto. It's yeah. just this wise old man, but he has this thing and then he's pervy towards women. But it's funny, ha ha ha. And it's like, mm-hmm. it's not, but it's like, that's how it's treated. I think a lot of it was conscious choices that the creators knew this works, this gets laugh, people mm-hmm. like this. And although this is marketed towards girl, if we want to pull in some guys, we should show a little skin.
So I guess all of that being said, looking at Sailor Moon as a whole, do we think that it is something we would recommend to girls now?
I think I would, but I would also point them in the direction of other more recent manga and anime that I feel handles things better. But I think I would. I mean, it's so iconic. And it was one of the first ones that we had our female leads. I mean, she wasn't a supporting character. She wasn't the love interest. She was the lead. She was the hero. There is no one stronger than her. And it had this group of girls and they were all the heroes. It was, I don't know. I feel like it's too iconic to not recommend
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I mean, I think similarly, I grew up with it. And so I obviously, like, my nostalgia definitely tints how I view it. And I've asked myself this several times, because I do see a lot of what is wrong with the representation. It does come from that kind of 90s era of mm-hmm. it was definitely heading in the right direction, but it mm-hmm. still had its own problems. I think of, you know, just Buffy and Charmed mm-hmm. and all of those. It's kind of like there is feminism there, but it's kind of problematic feminism. You're kind mm-hmm. of getting into your own and being able to really tell your stories. But like Heather said, you are still tinged by your own culture and the male gaze as well. I think I would still recommend it, but I mean, one of the things that I really enjoy about consuming any type of media is just reading all of the think pieces about them mm-hmm. and like the way that people like think through watching Sailor Moon. I think that that would be good supplemental reading because I think that it gives context to a lot of things and helps readers think about certain things in a different light.
Yeah, I'm on the same boat. I mean, nostalgia is a huge factor for this with this for me. I would still recommend it. And readers, the kids are as curious as ever. The perspective that they'll be reading it will be different than ours at the same time because we're reading back and we're mm-hmm. adults and it's just like, this should have changed. Yeah, I would still definitely recommend it. It still very much shows a lot of good.
Yeah, I think I would for sure recommend the manga. Like, I don't really have many reservations about that. Like, it actually holds up pretty well. I mean, sure, there's some like sort of problematic things. And like even with the female creator, there's some male gaze issues that are just like very common throughout manga and body image issues and things like that. But I think that that's just part of the genre to some degree. And so like just going into it and knowing that that is part of it and then being able to talk about it. And it is, it's totally iconic. Like, I think that it's if you like manga at all, this is a must read. And like it's also, I think, a good starting point for girls that want to get into manga still. Mm-hmm. The anime, I have really mixed feelings about. Having watched it now, I don't know. I think I could recommend watching it, but with like a whole lot of, hey, just in advance, there's some really problematic things in this, which then I think it would just depend on the age of the person I was recommending it to. Mm-hmm. Like I would have no issues recommending it to my oldest daughter because she would just be throughout like, that's gross. Like what is, that's not acceptable, you know? But then I think she would also find certain things pretty progressive given the time. Mm-hmm. So like, I think she could get her way through it without internalizing things in a weird way. Like she's already at that level, but for like a really young girl, maybe with some hand holding, like watching together. So that somebody's bringing up like, that's not cool. Like that's not good at all. So yes, wholeheartedly on the manga for me.
Well, that's it for this special episode of These Books Made Me Manga Edition. As always, feel free to drop us a tweet. We're at PGCMLS on Twitter and hashtag These Books Made Me with suggestions for books and manga you'd like to see us cover in the future.